You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. And this is episode 245 of Columbia Calling. We've had some interesting shows in the recent weeks. We've had, Janneke Niemeyer, no relation to Tanya Niemeyer, I hasten to add, Janneke Niemeyer on the phone from Amsterdam, talking about fair trade Coke. That has created a fair amount of movement along the networks and the ether, people talking about that a little bit, especially in the wake of the addresses given by President Ivan Duque and, of course, President Trump in the United Nations this last week about the war on drugs and so on. Which brings me, actually, very, very easily there to my very special guest who's on the line from Amsterdam as well. So that's 2 weeks in a row with people from Amsterdam. But she's originally from Ohio, via other places, I think, too. But her name is Abby Steele. She's the assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Amsterdam and the author of a book entitled Democracy and Displacement in Colombia's Civil War. Welcome on Columbia Calling, Abby.
Thank you very much, Richard.
You're most welcome. Thank you for taking the time out of your incredibly busy day. And I know you have to look after your children later and an academic. How do you balance everything?
Badly at the moment.
I find it incredibly hard with only one child. I don't know how you do it with two.
I don't either, honestly. I think I'm in a hazy period of my life.
That's right. So when you wake up in the next decade, you'll be like, what happened in those wilderness years?
I'll be like, thank God I survived.
Well, let's say we have a couple of friends friends or contacts or acquaintances in common, which is really cool to see. I mean, one of my former teachers and a friend of mine, Pedro Valenzuela, he's been given a thank you. He's mentioned in your book, and I saw that Alex Fatal is a great friend of yours. I interviewed him on episode 168, I think, in December 2016. So what goes around comes around, you know. It's Colombia. It's a small bubble.
Yeah, it's, I guess we all kind of coalesce together.
And now, what I was reading, before we get into your book a little bit more, what I was reading is that you spent time with Alex up there in Cazuca, way down south Bogota. How did you end up coming to Colombia and end up in Cazuca?
Well, while I was in college, I actually worked with Adam Isaacson, who's now at WOLA.
Yes.
Probably a familiar name to many of your listeners. I had the great privilege to be his intern, where I learned quite a lot from him. And we were working on sort of lobbying against Plan Colombia from the U.S. side as it stood then. Of course, we were unsuccessful in the lobbying effort. But as I learned more about Colombia, I decided I would really like to actually visit Colombia because at that time I hadn't. And so I applied for a Fulbright scholarship following university. And it turns out not many other people wanted to go to Bogota in 2001, 2002.
Yeah, there's some reasons behind that.
Along with Alex, actually. That's how I met Alex.
Go on, please.
I was just going to say, and then in terms of getting to Cazuca, Alex was already working in a neighborhood there called El Progreso, and I sort of tagged along with a couple of other friends, and we thought that we could try to... It was more a very, I would say, naive effort to keep teenagers in the neighborhood busy who weren't able to go to high school for one reason or another. So yeah, we organized a theater group with them.
Wow. A naive attempt. It was unsuccessful?
Well, I think it was successful in the sense that we did manage to keep people busy, but it was like a very stereotypical, I'm an American bleeding heart who's just here to help and this kind of thing. And in the end, of course, there were so many factors so much bigger than we were that were really depressing that we really couldn't circumvent, right? Like, we tried to help one kid go back to high school, for example, but it was so difficult, even with the resources, that it didn't really work out for him. And, you know, I tried to talk to the girls about that they could say no if they didn't want to have sex, or if they needed condoms, we can get them condoms. And, you know, and like the year I went back, they were all pregnant. Mm. So.
Yeah, it's so, the realities.
It's the real a confrontation with reality. And at the same time, I would say that I learned so much from being with them and spending time with them. And
but it's really a formative period in your academia and personal life. And of course, you learn from the man. I mean, there's possibly no person who knows Columbia better than Adam Isaacson, in my opinion. I mean, the guy is, we all go to him as journalists for every quote.
No, I agree. And I really learned also just in general how to be a good advocate, because he taught me that you really just have to describe things rigorously. And that's the best form of advocacy, because it should be pretty clear that things are out of balance most of the time.
Definitely. Well, I mean, coming into it with the right, let's say, filter on your eyes. And I understand, you know, young American coming down, going to these impoverished areas. I do it as well as a Brit and so on. We've all been there. I mean, it's our kind of Peace Corps hangover type thing. And I can only imagine the academic Arturo Escobar, you know, looking at us and saying, you are the reason I write what I write, you know, the sort of the creation of the third world. But a fantastic experience, though. I mean, regardless of what may be the sort of existential crises that we encounter in these types of things. But so you were down in Kazukai, but you spent most of your time in Bogota. But then I guess you came back a year later, visited Kazukai, like you said, the girls are all pregnant, but you went further into the country after that. I mean, this changed your outlook. You wanted to see more of Colombia.
Well, yeah, I would say when I was there in 2002, we were really discouraged from traveling very much, other than by airplane. So at that time I saw Cartagena and Cali and Santa Marta, but when I went back, one thing I realized while I was in Colombia really was that I wanted more training on how to do real research. Because actually, I don't know if we have time for this anecdote, but when we were Fulbright scholars there, Alex actually helped me with another sort of miniature research project on the marriage agencies in Colombia. Mm-hmm. So he called this marriage agency and asked for a date, basically, so we could interview a woman. Like, we were so young and so silly.
Oh, no.
And we hung out all night with this girl who was so nice, and we just had a great time with her and chatted about, you know, the marriage agency. And I ended up going to several other agencies over the course of the year. But I realized I had no idea how to conduct rigorous research, and that I became really interested in that. And so then I went back to grad school.
Mm. I want to jump in about the marriage agency. So you met you set up a date with this girl who potentially thought she was going to meet the love of her life. Was she not upset that she was, you know, a research project?
Well, no, she wasn't upset, thankfully. I mean, this is another, it was completely naive, but the agency that she worked at was really strange. So she didn't have a choice, really. Uh-huh. She didn't see Alex, right? There was no, like, exchange beforehand of, like, oh, yeah, okay, I will go on a date with you. It was, like, the agency just sent her to meet someone. And most of the women who I met later, because I actually stayed in a marriage agency in Cali, and then was had access to a lot of women who would come to the agency and look at pictures or, you know, meet men at the agency. Some of the men asked me to translate for them. It was very strange.
This is bizarre.
It was so bizarre. Yeah, without knowing very much about agencies at the time, the agency that the young woman was involved in was just sort of said, do you want to go out with an American tonight? And she said yes, and she was just very easygoing about it. She didn't have any kind of romantic ideas that she was going to meet the love of her life that night, or ever through an agency, actually. She was quite cynical.
Okay. Well, all right. And can I just ask, have you written anything about this that we can see? Any project that you've written about your experiences?
No, I wish I had. You know, I keep thinking about it, and I just wasn't sure how to go about writing about it. Maybe one day I'll write an essay about my time staying in a marriage agency in Cali, because I came across some characters.
I think even more than an academic article, I just think it would be make for great reading somewhere. I don't know where we publish it, but if great reading, that you know, the title, That Time I Stayed in a Marriage Agency in Colombia.
Okay. Well, the encouragement, I will take it under advisement.
Well, because I could just imagine, and hang on, when you were saying, because I'm now completely trapped in this whole circle of whatever, but when you were staying there, were these gentlemen, let's say, from the United States, were they actually physically in Cali when you were translating it, or were you doing it sort of online?
Yeah. No, so I interviewed several men who were visiting Cali to meet someone. Mm-hmm. And the most surprising thing to me about the men was that there was a lot of variation in region that they came from, socioeconomic background, age, even race. Mm-hmm. I had a picture of one kind of man who would do this, and they were there. You know, that kind of man is like a divorced, middle-aged white man who kind of is in like a mid-range business world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So that was my stereotype of who I thought would participate, and they were there, but I would say they weren't even the majority. There was just a mix of all kinds of men.
These are eye-opening experiences, you know, and also, you know, the pulling the veil on that stereotype that we had. You put it very politely. I would have put it differently, but let's not get into that. But I think, you know, you that's really fascinating when you say that it comes from every sort of social strata and background. You just don't expect it.
No, it was really unexpected. And they were really willing to speak with me, which I also didn't expect. There were only a couple who were really uninterested in talking to me. The rest were super comfortable with me being there as this kind of 22, 23-year-old white girl.
Yeah. And they didn't try and hit on you as well?
Sorry?
They didn't try and pick you up either? I mean, it's...
Oh, no. Not at all.
Okay, so no. you were shielded, let's say. You were the go-between.
Yeah, I made up this story. Like, the rationale for why I was there was that my dad's divorced friend wanted me to check out whether or not these agencies were legit. And these guys, I don't know if they cared or bought it or anything, but... I mean, one guy I remember saying, oh, yeah, tell your dad to get down here. Like, he'll find someone right away. And I just looked at him like, dude, I am not shopping for my stepmom. I have no shame whatsoever. It was interesting.
Where have we gone? I mean, we're not off topic because we're on Columbia and it is fascinating. And I know my listeners will be interested. But I mean, I promise that we will talk about your book and we will talk about some of, let's say, more hard-hitting issues going on. But this takes us quite neatly to the end of this first segment of the show. So therefore, we had a nice, affable opening to this episode 245 with you there from in Amsterdam talking about potentially or not shopping for your stepmother, but it's a very, very interesting experiences, incredibly, I would say, profound experiences, giving you a completely different insight into the country and the type of people who interacted with Colombia in that period of time. I think it defines you a little bit, doesn't it? When you start changing your outlook on these things.
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think, I mean, the funny part of this experience is talking about the kind of men I encountered and their impressions, or our impressions of each other. But I think the more interesting or meaningful part to me was all the women that I spoke with who were involved in agencies and why they were doing it. And they were similarly had a huge range of women, professional women, you know, single moms, different age groups, and also really willing to speak with me. I mean, this was only one agency, and there was a lot of rumors about different levels of coercion among agencies. Mm. But the one I was at was, as you can imagine, pretty relaxed. Otherwise, they wouldn't just let me hang up.
Yeah.
one woman that I ended up translating her date with was really interested in why I was there, who I was, and how she could get a visa, and she wants to travel the world too, and we had a really nice conversation following her date. And then I went back in the agency, and the man was like a teenager. He was like, "What did she say about me?" And I was like, "We didn't talk about you at all."
Yes. So you had a date with the girl.
Yeah, we had a really nice chat time with her. She was really scared off by the fact that he had 40 dogs.
Does anyone have 40 dogs? I'm sorry.
I know, it was really unreasonable. She thought she heard, so she looked at me and she said, "Cuatro?" And I was like, no. Hi, Dios mio.
Well, there you go. This would make for fantastic reading. The man with 40 dogs. Anyway, let's take a short break and come back and talk further about your experiences in Colombia, but of course about your book, Democracy and Displacement in Colombia's Civil War. This is episode 245 of Colombia Calling, and we're talking to Abby Steele, who's the assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Amsterdam. But as you can hear, she's originally from the United States. We'll take a short break and be right back to talk further about Colombia with Abby. Thank you for listening. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And my very special guest this week is the assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Amsterdam, Abby Steele. She's over on the line in Amsterdam at the moment. And we've been talking a little bit about everything, experiences in Colombia. I think everybody has kind of bizarre experiences in Colombia. It's that sort of place. It lends itself to anecdotes and different experiences. We were talking about the marriage agencies, which I hadn't expected to talk about, but I'm very happy we did so, because it brought a certain lightness and a joviality to this episode. Before we plunge perhaps into the subjects of Abby's book, Democracy and Displacement in Colombia's Civil War, I guess this brings me to saying, if we finish up with the marriage agency that you lived with in Cali, where you stayed at and helped with, did you meet women then who were obviously displaced from the violence and looking for a way out of Colombia?
No, or at least not to my knowledge. I think Most of the women involved in the agencies are more, have a little more stability in their lives. And the agencies also screen for women. So I didn't meet any to my knowledge. In Kasuka, when I was working in the neighborhood there, of course, were displaced families.
Of course.
Yeah,
Kasuka is one of those areas. It's, let's say, what we call the, you know, invasiones, I guess, really, isn't it? But I would admit to my listeners out there, I have not read Abby's book, off the record, and you can hear it out there. As soon as I see it pirated in downtown Bogota, I will buy it. But it does look, I mean, I have read the peer reviews of the book, and it looks very impressive and incredibly well researched, which is something is kind of amazing in Colombia when you try and go through archives in different parts of the country. And something I'm somewhat familiar with, even here in Bogota, and you just find boxes propping open doors or sitting in puddles. Your book is largely it talks about the conflict, the civil war, and also I think parallel to this issue, and obviously very much interconnected, is the war on drugs, and people write, you know, when they're writing about your book or when they mention your book, they say, you know, you put the civil war in the context on the of the war on drugs. The conflict for me in my mind has run so much longer because of the money from the drugs trade. But how do you research this? How do you find the details needed to create a coherent study?
Well, I think it's a mix of persistence and luck, really. So in my experience, in Colombia's civil war is pretty unique to other civil wars in the world in how much data are collected in terms of like quantitative data, really. Mm-hmm. So I know a lot of your listeners will be familiar with the fact that Colombia registers its internally displaced population and has, you know, now they have a victims registry, of course, it's broader than just displacement, but the majority of victims are still the displaced population. Mm-hmm. And there are problems with it, of course, we don't think everyone is registered who should be, but it's still much more exhaustive than other data sets on displaced people in the world. And so I initially started just analyzing that the registry and other sources of information about displacement, and realized that I wasn't really capturing anything that wasn't already something really intuitive, right? Where there's more violence, there's more displacement, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think we can confirm that again and again. And I decided I wanted to try to think about it from a different perspective. And so I wanted to do some field work and conduct more interviews in a region that experienced a lot of displacement, which is Urabá. Mm. And at the time I was planning my field work, it was 2006. So things in Urabá were a bit calmer than they had been, certainly, and then other regions of the country. So I went there and I talked to a lot of people, and I went to Medellin as well and interviewed people like former EPL commanders. One in particular who had spent his whole career in Urabá and had a really good memory. And could give me really detailed information about different neighborhoods, for example. I guess talking to more people, I started to hear and understand how the development of the region was really connected to the loyalties people developed to the armed groups, and as a result, sort of their vulnerability to armed groups who were going to contest the original ones to begin with, right? So, especially when the paramilitaries came in, they knew which neighborhoods to target, partly because it was common knowledge where the sort of FARC union union supporters lived in Aparthalo.
Yeah.
And partly because, I mean, that had, but what I found that was more interesting, I guess, and that ties it to a bigger kind of cautionary story, is that I'm not sure the paramilitaries would have targeted the people living in Aparthalo the way that they did if sort of the Union Patriótica hadn't come on the scene and if local level elections weren't held in the late 80s. And the reason is because a lot of the local political elites who had kind of just gone along with the FARC, or they reached a kind of steady coexistence. Of course, a lot of the local political elites were the banana plantation owners, and they needed the FARC's union workers and the EPL's union workers to actually make a profit from their banana plantation. But once their political power was challenged because there were elections and because there were so many voters in Urabá who were supporting the UPE candidates, I think they decided to form an alliance with paramilitary forces when they hadn't really been interested in that before. And that turned out to be really horrible for a lot of the civilians in the area. And as a result, what I call political cleansing happened, right? These neighborhoods that were sort of well-known supporters of the UPE and of the FARC were really targeted for expulsion. So those basically, you know, those people had to go. And I guess to tie it back into my original sort of analysis of the broader quantitative data, you know, it's true that we see an association with an increase in violence and an increase in displacement, but what happened in Aparthalo shows that, you know, violence increased because they wanted to displace people. And that's different, a different story than people are near violence and so they decide to leave because they're afraid, right? Which also happens, that also happens. But it's important to understand, you know, when armed groups specifically target civilians in order to make them leave rather than civilians just trying to get away from armed groups fighting each other, for example. Mm-hmm. So basically, yeah, the book is a really sad story about how well-intentioned democratic reforms sort of led to a new alignment of incentives and alliances. And that's really when we see, before then, we don't see a lot of displacement in the Colombian Civil War. Not in the 80s, it was very low levels. And once these elections started, you see paramilitaries kind of discovering a good tactic in their war against the FARC. And then you see it spread to other regions from Urabá.
Fascinating. Fascinating. So what I'm taking from this, obviously a vast deal, and what the listeners will take from this, you know, displacement existed, and you draw on the difference between types of displacement. But of course, the increase occurs when there's a democratization of, like, there's voting patterns in Colombia. So we, it's almost like when things started to decentralize and giving more voting authority to the regions, the violence increased.
Yeah, certainly.
Wow.
And this was one form of kind of decentralization. It was kind of a political decentralization where, you know, before 1988, the municipal alcaldes were appointed by the governors.
Yeah.
Right. And then this 1988, they could municipal residents could directly elect their alcaldes, and this started to really shake up local political competition, because of course before that it really depended more on who you knew and clientelism and this kind of thing. And so, yeah, I think this is a point where you see a lot of local political leaders thinking, "Oh, I don't like this.
Yeah.
I don't want to participate in democracy." And so they resorted to these kind of alliances with violent groups. And then you see after the Constitution of 91, you see other forms of decentralization, and other scholars have shown that this kind of administrative and fiscal decentralization also created new and different incentives for armed groups to target municipalities in ways that they didn't before. And so where they're really doing more of like capturing local institutions for themselves and sort of diverting these resources from the center. So one person, like Gustavo Duncan's book on Señores de la Guerra, talks about decentralization, and economists at Los Andes, like Fabio Sanchez, talks about the municipalization of the Colombian Civil War.
So when we're sort of talking about, when you talk about sort of like local institutions being taken over by people connected to or favorable of these armed groups, so they could feed information or channel the money elsewhere, I suppose.
Yeah, so we find, and one example is with the formalization of land. So I have a paper with Juan Vargas and Jake Shapiro and Rafael Che that just came out that shows how paramilitaries and the FARC sort of approached the capturing process differently, where in municipalities where the FARC was more dominant, they sort of discouraged land formalization, and there's much lower tax revenue, for example, because they just didn't seem to want the state to intervene. And we have also sort of corroborative evidence of that with interviews with administrators who were supposed to do a land survey, for instance, but were too afraid to go into an area where they thought the FARC were. And in contrast, in the paramilitary municipalities where they were more dominant, we see that there is a higher amount of tax revenue collected at the local level. And we hypothesize that this comes through more land formalization. So it's interesting that, you know, you would think that the paramilitaries would want to, you know, allow their land-owning cronies to avoid paying taxes, but we think that it was really a mechanism for them to claim, to, like, formalize this FOHO, basically. They pay a little bit of taxes, and then they get to formalize the land that was probably a shady acquisition. So those are two examples of how the armed groups influence these kind of local institutions that, in theory, the state should guarantee, you know, private property rights. But we know that it's very uneven in Colombia, and it's a big problem.
I find this absolutely fascinating that you basically you're proving, you know, that, okay, so let's say the paramilitaries and their cronies, or I guess regional political elites, are paying, you know, let's say a fraction of the taxes that they owe, or, you know, they're due to pay, and that, as you say, formalizes their land ownership, possibly of land, or probably of land where they've displaced the original colonos or settlers, or, you know, campesinos, in an untoward fashion. You know, I've talked to people who've been displaced in areas around the Montes de Maria and stuff like that, having been approached a year after having, you know, they're now living in the gym in San Jacinto, and someone, an intermediary, comes up and says, I'll give you this much money. And of course, they're at their wit's end. They've been on the floor of the gym for a year. Of course, they take it. And I just see that there's a paper trail that leads back to, let's say, around, well, let's say 2006, 2005, 432, that then provides these people with a certain legitimacy in the eyes of the law, even though it's outrageous.
Let me just say one thing. As social scientists, I wouldn't say that we've proven that, but there's a lot of sort of complementary pieces of evidence that this is a dynamic that goes on. And it's what we think shows that it happens is more in the direction of, you know, updating the catastro, for example. The municipality is supposed to do that, and then that's the basis on which land valuation is assessed, and then that's where they make the local tax rate decisions. And the municipalities themselves make a decision about how to tax and what rate to tax at. It's very decentralized. And so what we think is happening is that there's just more an effort to formalize and through the catastro and land valuation and everything, formalized new plots of land. And so those predios could have been owned by someone previously, or they could have just never been registered. It could have been completely informal. So we can't see it directly. It's all kind of indirect evidence, but it's very suspicious. And it's interesting that where the FARC was dominant, you see the opposite. There's a lot less land formality and less tax revenue.
The collective.
So it's less tax revenue collected by those municipalities.
Yeah.
And so if you have more plots of land that are supposed to pay taxes, on average, you'll have higher tax revenue collected, even if the rates of taxes are fairly low, right?
Fascinating.
So that's what we think is more going on, where the paramilitaries had influence.
So, and we keep coming back to the same point. Obviously, it's a key point in your book and a key point, but it's land. And when people ask me for, basic overviews of the problems in Colombia and why they persist to this day, I always come back to it. I mean, there's obviously so many different variations to create the complexities in today's Colombia, but I come back to it as land. I don't know, there's political participation and elites and so on, but land seems to be something that's so central to everything here.
It's central, and I think the state's inability to regulate the ownership of land is really essential too, and it elites. You know, another thing I think that people who love Colombia know about Colombia is that it is so legalistic and bureaucratic, and there are so many hoops to jump through to get a title to land. And there are so many hoops, and you would think, oh, they really have everything organized, you know, and they're so orderly or something. But all of those regulations benefit only the wealthy and well-connected who can manage to get all of that done. So it's a really unequal distribution of private property protection that skews towards all of the very well-connected people in rural areas. And they still use violence to make sure that status quo is maintained. Even to the point where they tried to carry out, you know, the Censo Agropecuario, I think last year or the year before, the DANE.
Yeah.
And a lot of their enumerators were threatened.
Yeah.
You know, it's a major challenge for the country to modernize. It's
terrifying in that respect. I have a small business up in Mompox in Bolivar, and I see it. You know, you see it. It's there's no effort to hide these things. These are practices that are you know, performed in plain sight. That's what's so I think so terrifying at sometimes. Now, if I can be just go, you know, we've only got a couple of minutes left. You went up and you not only obviously saw these areas, Urabá, and we talked about them voting for the Unión Patriótica, but you also, you knew that obviously we've seen from voting, centralized voting records that, you know, the UP got their votes up there and so on, but you checked out the archives up there in Apartado and so on, and these archives were available for you to look at, presumably they were available for the armed groups to look at for their displacement motives.
Yeah, I mean, in theory. So, but the documents that I stumbled upon actually, because they aren't well organized or anything, and they were in this kind of half covered attic of the Registraduría in these binders. It was a big mess. I don't think the armed groups would have studied them or been able to analyze them so directly, because they were huge spreadsheets of the cédula.
Okay.
And the sort of mesa de votación. So what I did to show how many people left that had been registered by polling stations in 1994 compared to how many people were registered in 1998 and 2000. And so I could just compare around the polling station, but I had to first hire an assistant to help me digitize all of that information because they were, you know, 13,000 registered voters. I think only in Comuna 1 or something, right? So it took a lot of work to be able to analyze the data.
Huge amount of work to do this. But, you know, fantastic that you were able to do it and put this book together. And there are some incredible reviews about it online. But as we're closing this down, and as I say, thank you so much for your time, and I think we could talk for hours about this. I know you could.
Yeah.
But I want to ask, you know, in the light of last week's UN General Assembly addresses and so on and so forth, how do you feel regarding the Duque presidency this next 4 years? I mean, you're someone who's, you know, known Colombia quite intimately since 2002. You have to have an opinion, but so drop your shield of social scientist and let the emotion out. don't do it. Protect yourself.
Function about that. No, I was really sad that he said that things didn't work out differently over the course of the elections. But so far, I've been not totally. I think I had really low expectations, and I'm still waiting to see what will happen. I think certainly it's discouraging to hear what Duque has to say about the war on drugs, which is something you raised before. I think the approach that Colombia had used has not worked, and it sounds like he's still, in any case, advocating a return to that. And, you know, Trump is also supporting the, for some reason, the elimination of coca. So that will be news to, I mean, of coca.
Of coca, yeah, that's right.
That will be really bad news for USAID that supports tons of cocoa growing initiatives in Colombia. So, yeah, I think that's discouraging. I think it won't work. I think it's already shown many, many times it doesn't work. So I don't know what to think about that. And I think that's a huge challenge for Colombia, in addition to the land question, is figuring out how to deal with coca in a way that allows the state to establish, you know, nonviolent legal conflict resolution in these areas, because as long as coca is there, armed groups are going to regulate it. Mm-hmm. And of course they resort to violence. They don't have courts, right?
Yeah.
So it's a very difficult puzzle for Colombia to try to solve, and I'm disappointed that it sounds like Duque is not interested in thinking more creatively about how to solve it.
I think you put that very succinctly, and yes, I think you know, we say we're disappointed. I thought we'd finish on this point. I continue to have incredibly low expectations for this presidency, and I like, exactly as you say, disappointed in his speech and obviously his actions for a war on drugs, you know, obviously paid for, I think, by the administration to the north. But at the same time, sort of, I'm just waiting for the big, like, calamity sort of thing. I feel like, you know, Duque in this moment in time is just sort of treading water, you know, trying to convince us with his talks of national unity and peace for all Colombians. But I'm waiting for something massive to happen that we can all say, yeah, I told you so.
Well, yeah, I think it's. I think it can also be a slow drift problem.
Yeah, maybe.
Because the implementation of the peace agreement is so complex and requires so much legal change and coordination among all of these agencies. And so far, there's very little evidence that they're managing to make headway. Although I think Archila, and you know, I think he's a very serious man, and so that's encouraging. But there's only so much. There's only so much one person can do. I don't know. I'm concerned.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's leave it on that point. And let me say thank you so much for your time.
Let me say something more positive.
Okay.
No, I don't know. I don't actually have something.
It's
so sad.
No.
The anti-corruption, I know. The anti-corruption measure, that was a really positive mobilization, I think. And it was outstanding that Duque took it seriously and invited the FARC leaders to come to the Casa de Niño, and so that's a positive note.
Okay. We'll take that. It was positive as well. The turnout, I mean, it just shows that, you know, let's say a more liberal bent to the country now can mobilize, let's say, the youthful vote. It's a huge deal. It's a huge deal here in Colombia. So that is a positive note. Let me say thank you. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for explaining your research and about your book, Democracy and Displacement in Colombia's Civil War. When I can get hold of a copy, I will get hold of a copy, I promise. So we have been talking, you're welcome, to Abby Steele, who's an assistant professor at the Department of Political Science at the University of Amsterdam. Again, thank you for your time. It's been really, really fascinating to talk to someone with such an academic, but also, you know, on the ground, real experience of Colombia, and put it into a book. And of course, I'm sure you're lecturing your students almost daily on Colombia.
I try.
Okay, so. This has been episode 245 of Colombia Calling. I know you've been out there and enjoying it. Next week, we're going to have the guys from the film Bastards y Diablos, which was filmed down here in Colombia, and they're opening it up for new release on Cine Colombia on the 18th of October, if I'm not mistaken. So please ensure that you tune in to hear about that. And if you're here in Bogota, Medellin, or Cartagena, they will have screenings in Cine Colombia in those places. But thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week, as I said, with Andrew Perez, Dylan, and the others from Bastards y Diablos. This has been a great episode, and I am saying farewell now. Thank you again. Bye-bye.